Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, all. Just a reminder that you could have already listened to this episode early and ad-free over at Grab Bag Collab's Patreon page at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. At the $8 tier, you get this show without ads a few days early, plus you get Strange and Unexplained with Daisy Egan early and ad-free, plus you get at least 3 more exclusive shows you can't find anywhere else, and the option to join higher tiers for behind-the-scenes and bonus content while supporting a profit-sharing company. If that's something that intrigues you, hop on over to patreon.com/grabbagcollab. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The bus driver was in his underwear when he was told to climb down the ladder and into a dark hole. He had no idea where he was headed or who was waiting for him when he got there. He did know that it was 3:30 in the morning because the men who had taken him had not asked for his watch when they took his clothes from him. He knew that even if the worst awaited him, it was best he went first because he sure didn't want any of the 26 children waiting to follow him down there to be alone in that dark place. He had a fleeting thought that if these guys wanted money, they'd pick the wrong school district and the wrong town. He was handed a flashlight and then descended down the steps into what looked like an old 8-foot by 26-foot tractor-trailer container. He could see the floor of the receptacle was lined with mattresses. He could hear some fans that were whirring behind some vent. Then, one by one, Ed Ray helped each of the children down and placed them on the mattresses. When the loading of the underground container was done, the masked men lowered a 400-pound steel plate over the opening that they had crawled through. Unbeknownst to Ray, they then put heavy batteries on top of the manhole cover, shoveled 3 feet of dirt over that, and left the premises. All Ray knew was that he was alone with these kids, some as young as 5, whimpering, crying, and screaming for their mothers. When the bus he was driving had been hijacked, it was just about 4 o'clock on the day before the last day of summer school. Ray had stopped the bus in the rural back roads of Madera County, California, when he tried to drive around a white van that was blocking the road. Thus began the largest mass kidnapping in the history of this country. 27 people, all taken from a school bus and placed in a massive underground prison cell to await being freed. Assuming, of course, they lived through the oppressive heat and the lack of air and the abject fear. Mike Marshall, then 14, told the CBS News magazine 48 Hours that he remembered the moment after the kidnappers had placed the steel cylinder over the opening that they had climbed through.
And there it just went dark. And you just hear the material getting throat on us. We've been buried alive.
It was July 15th, 1976. Ed Ray was an ordinary 55-year-old man put in an extraordinary position. He would prove to be the most decent and responsible of men, a brave soul who cuddled, cajoled, and comforted 26 children who had even less of an idea of what was going on than he did.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It took parents only about an hour to figure out something was very wrong. The calls started to pour into the Madera County Sheriff's Department. The day watch commander called another officer, a pilot, and told him to get a plane in the air and start looking for the missing bus. He then took a car and drove the bus route himself while Madera County Sheriff Ed Bates called the governor and said, "We need some help here." Chowchilla is a small town located smack dab in the middle of California with a population of 5,000 in 1976. Two state prisons are located there. Its median annual income of around $7,000 at the time was little more than half the national average. This was farm country and had a lot of migrant workers who called it home. But it was also a small town in the best sense of the phrase. Everybody knew everybody else. And in this case, all the pilots knew all the other pilots, and pretty soon, there were a lot of eyes in the sky looking for a runaway bus. There were a lot of eyes on the ground looking too. By now, the California Highway Patrol was helping search the area, and so were dozens of volunteers combing the lonely back roads, spreading out in all directions. At 7:15 p.m., the bus was spotted in a dry riverbed. Around the bus, 20-foot-tall bamboo stood guard and made it invisible from the street. Sheriff's deputies flooded the scene but found the bus empty except for damp bathing suits and towels left on the seats by children who had been celebrating their final days of summer school. There were some tire tracks that led nowhere. Ed Ray and the children, 19 were girls, 7 were boys, had met trouble on Road 21 midway through the bus's route. The bus had slowed to move around a stalled van when two masked men emerged and told Ray to open the bus door. The gunmen then got on the bus and told Ray to move to the back. One gunman went with him, holding a sawed-off shotgun on him the whole time. The other got into the driver's seat and drove to the riverbed. One child on the bus, 10-year-old Jennifer Brown, would later say she thought it was some kind of joke. You know, end of the term fun thing? That they were being taken to, like, a party or something. But it quickly felt differently.
Edward was speaking in a harsh tone, and that normally was not the Edward that we knew and loved.
Now get used to Jennifer. And all of the news reports that followed, both on TV and in the papers, it would be this confident, smart, little blue-eyed girl who would step up to the plate and tell people what the kids were thinking and doing and feeling during their long ordeal. It would be Jennifer who talked to the cops, to reporters, her mom said it was okay, and who testified in court when the time came. Jennifer was, and is, one cool chick who, when she figured out what was happening, told the kidnappers that her daddy was a reserve deputy and if she was so much as 5 minutes late getting off that bus, he'd come looking for her. They didn't care. Soon enough, everybody was loaded into the white van and another that was green. Each had their windows painted black and had a partition separating the kids from the driver in front. 14 kids and Ed Ray got in one van, 12 kids got in the other. Ray was pressed against the back of the van door, with children laying on his arms and legs, each one holding onto some part of Ray's body. No light seeped in. Survivor Larry Park told 48 Hours that the darkness was like an abyss.
At 6 years old, I had never been in darkness like that before. It was just pitch black. Like the dark was touching me, engulfing me, like I was actually inhaling the darkness.
Hardly anyone could breathe, so eventually Ray tore up the carpet and, through some holes in the underbelly of the van, new air could pass through. They rode that way, stopping 3 times, but never being allowed out. Ray reported later that he could not hear traffic or anything that would indicate to him where they were. But they drove and drove, with the kids occasionally taking it upon themselves to bang on the partition and beg the driver to let them go. All the time, Ray worried about the kids in the other van and wondered how they were faring. Then the van stopped. It was about 3 in the morning of the next day, pitch dark outside. They had been driving for about 11 hours. The kidnappers told the children to get off the bus one at a time. The terrified kids still left on the bus didn't know if the kids being let off were being killed one at a time somewhere out there in the dark. Jennifer remembered.
I felt like I was an animal going to the slaughterhouse.
Instead, once they stepped out, the children were asked their names and asked to take off a piece of their clothing so their parents would be given proof that no one was playing here. One 12-year-old had his glasses taken from him. Jennifer gave up a flip-flop as she'd already lost one somewhere early on in the escapade and figured the other wouldn't do much good for her. Then they followed Ray 12 feet down into the subterranean holding cell. It had been a moving van in a past life, where they found peanut butter, dry cereal, sliced bread, crackers, and water. They also saw that the kidnappers had cut 2 holes in the floor for use as toilets. Jennifer would tell authorities later that when someone used the makeshift potty, other kids would hold up a blanket for privacy because, you know, this whole thing was hard enough. She had also been afraid at one time that one of the little kids was dead, but he'd only been asleep. Jennifer would explain that, sometime during all of this, a group of little girls started to sing to take people's minds off the circumstances. Someone began singing, "If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands." No one clapped.
We all tried to comfort each other.
And a few of my little friends that are 5 and 6 that came over and started laying on me and crying. And I told them, "Be brave, because everything's going to be all right."
There was a lot of crying, but nobody was hurt. Not really, if you don't count the discomfort related to the fear and the heat and the claustrophobia and the smell. Kids stood in line to get whiffs of air from the badly working fan. A dismayed child busied himself kicking a post that was shoring up the moving van's interior structure. Soon enough, the roof began to give. Jennifer said she was afraid of being quote-unquote squooshed. So was everybody else.
The fans on the ventilator stopped. My little brain started to grasp the concept of, we may really not go home. As a young kid, you don't have a lot of sense of time. There was no sunlight, so you couldn't tell if it was day or night.
Ed Ray and Mike Marshall noticed that the sides of the crate were sagging as well. They decided they would try to claw their way out. Ed later told KCRA-TV.
So me and a couple boys decided we'd better start digging. We was gonna lose our lives there, same as getting, if we dug ourselves out. So when we started to move the steel plate, we couldn't hardly move it because it had 2 great big old batteries on top of it. Then we got that plate up, guts and everything else, to try to cool off and go back up and dig some more.
Meanwhile, back in Chowchilla, law enforcement from everywhere started showing up to help. President Gerald Ford directed the Federal Bureau of Investigation to spare no expense, sending 30 agents to take to the air and on horseback, commandeering scent-smelling dogs and forensic specialists to scour the backwoods of Central California. This was an era where the citizen band radio, and citizens anxious to use it, were ubiquitous. Where everybody reported everything to everybody else from clunky, bulky radios in their cars. The chatter was especially popular with lonely long-haul truckers, but lots of people had CB radios. A lot assumed handles, like they were Top Gun pilots, names like Smokey or the Bandit. And during this mid-July crisis in Chowchilla, chatter exploded, which gave investigators pause as they knew that the kidnappers could be listening to every development, where the cops were at any time, who they were talking to, and where they were executing warrants. There was nothing they could do to stop it. But the truth was, they had nowhere to even start looking for real information aside from the abandoned bus. No ransom note had been received, and the motive was anybody's guess. Well, actually, Sheriff Bates was willing to guess. He said it was one of five things. 1, a deranged guy. 2, someone wanting personal revenge on a parent. 3, a terrorist plot. 4, some older kid on the bus thought it might be funny. Or 5, good old-fashioned cash. From a newscast at the time.
Any chance at all this could be some kind of terrible hoax or joke that someone is playing?
I imagine there's a chance. I hope that's all it is.
The Dairyland School District Superintendent Leroy Tatum ventured a guess at the kidnappers' identities. Quote, "Well, they weren't our screwballs. Our screwballs aren't smart enough," end quote. Not helpful, really. Still, police remembered that they had received a number of reports a few days earlier of suspicious van activity in the area around where the bus had been stopped. On Friday morning, the day after the kidnappings, the cops decided that they would go public with that and try to make that crowdsourcing thing work for them. It did. A local woman called the sheriff to say she had seen those vans people were talking about and had written down a complete license plate for one of them. The authorities immediately took the number to the California DMV. They came up with a name and a fictitious address in San Jose. But they also had records that pointed them straight to the prior owner who had sold the van, and he was happy to help. Meanwhile, underground, the little crew worked the problem with their hands and finally managed to shove aside the 419-pound steel cover. On top of that was a box into which Mike Marshall could poke his head. Mike made a recording of himself describing the moment. The recording is tough to make out, but he says, quote, "I started pounding on this box, started hitting it and pounding it, hitting it and pounding it. None of us knew if, when we got out, there'd be shotguns aimed at our heads. We were scared," end quote. On top of the box were two heavy diesel batteries that they lowered slowly, one at a time. Then they ran into the 3-foot-thick layer of dirt. They refused to give up. They kept at it. Anytime energy would wane, Mike Marshall would say, "Keep digging." Suddenly, a shaft of light filtered through the hole. Even little Larry, who was only 6 when he was kidnapped, remembered that moment.
This ray of sunlight came down into the opening. It was catching the dust, and the dust particles looked like a bunch of shooting stars.
Around 8 p.m., twilight really, 16 hours after they had been forced to climb down into the darkness, Mike poked his head into the open air. He couldn't see anyone but the familiar hills to the west. Then, with Ray's help, he lifted 26 dirty, partially clothed children out of their little hell.
We all just scurried like a bunch of little mice. We saw conveyor belts, excavators. It looked like the Flintstones. And all these men with hard hats came to us and looked at us like, "Who are you?"
It took no time to realize they had found the children the whole country was searching for. The California Rock and Cement Company was only 100 miles from where the bus snapping had occurred. The 11 hours in the vans, then, had just been spent driving around to confuse the hostages. Ray had thought that the tunnelers were going to emerge in the middle of the Pacific Northwest woods And he'd secretly fretted how he was going to get 26 kids to safety if they had to sleep and hike and live off the land for a time. But they emerged in the middle of a quarry. It was not an active work site, nor had it been for years. Their buried enclosure, Ray could see, was surrounded by brush that was easily 6 feet high. Cops swarmed in. The kids were taken to the Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center, put in fresh, oversized prison garb, and fed. Some of the children had random cuts and bruises. A few had fainted during the ordeal. There had been bloody noses, maybe some heat exhaustion, but nothing really that required hospitalization. Someone found Ray something to wear, and he stayed at the quarry to help the FBI understand what had happened there. California Lieutenant Governor Melvin DeMolly was on the scene to announce,
"Just confirmed by the Alameda County Sheriff that the children have been found in a quarry."
This chaotic scene comes from KCRA-TV in California.
"That's all the information I have now. You give me 5 more minutes, I'll get some more details."
"How are they? Are they okay?"
"It is reported that they are well. Some are..."
But the parents would have to wait a bit to see their children because doctors needed to fully examine them, and the police and FBI wanted to speak to the kids individually before their stories got confused.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
After the children, Bus Snapped and Chowchilla were discovered in a quarry, it did not take long for the FBI to ask quarry workers who had keys to get in. The list was short. It included the owner and his son, Frederick Nickerson Woods III, a descendant of a prominent family that traces its way back to the Mayflower. After a California branch of the family made good in the gold rush days, the multiple descendants still owned 1.4 million acres of land across the state, including the Magic Mountain theme park near Los Angeles. The people at the quarry soon remembered that 3 men had been digging a big hole at the quarry a while back. One had said he was Woods Jr.'s son. When Daddy Woods was called, he told the supervisor to give Woods III the run of the property. Someone else at the quarry then remembered that Woods and 2 of his pals had gotten into a little trouble in Sierra County a few years back as well. While they were on some kind of junk car collecting adventure, Woods and these 2 others had found what they thought was an abandoned car and began working on it, you know, to get it going so they could take it back downstate. A cop rolled up and asked if they owned the car. They replied they'd found it riddled with bullet holes and figured it was fair game. The cop wasn't convinced. He took them in and they were charged with grand theft auto, which got lowered to felony joyriding. Then they paid a fine and all was well. Except that in October 1974, the police in the beautiful county, divided by the Pacific Crest, had taken some mugshots of these 3 nice, well-behaved victims of a misunderstanding, and the FBI had something now that they could really work with. Pictures of the men they were looking for. Especially now that it had been a few days since anyone had seen hide nor hair of Fred Woods III, and his 2 partners in crime that day, brothers James and Richard Schoenfeld. They were not just nice and polite young men. Fred and James were 26, Richard was 22, but they were also nicely situated. Woods lived with his parents on a 78-acre ranch on the wealthy San Francisco Peninsula that had paddocks full of horses and rows of vintage automobiles in various states of repair. Woods was loosely in business with one of his high school friends, Jim Schoenfeld, who would be described later as a Boy Scout kind of guy, who loved Disney movies and the Beach Boys and watched Wild Kingdom on TV. Together, the two had bought an old school bus once, refurbished it, and resold it. They also acquired a rundown Victorian mansion and wanted to move it to the city of Mountain View, but ran into a few snags there, money being one, and a lot of paperwork being the other. The two otherwise hung out, creating money-making schemes, sometimes with Jim's kid brother Richard along for the ride. The Schoenfeld boys had grown up sons of a prominent Bay Area podiatrist. Jim was the car nut. Rick liked horses and was said to be interested in studying forestry. Back at the quarry, after the kids were safe, police followed leads that showed that Woods had bought two vintage vans from a Palo Alto storage company in November. They were the ones the police had just found 8 miles outside of Chowchilla. A CB radio was inside. All points bulletins were issued across the country, complete with mugshots for Woods and the Schoenfelds. They quickly appeared on wanted posters hung in America's post offices. Soon enough, law enforcement also found out that Fred and James had rented a warehouse in East San Jose where they moved the old vehicles they had purchased, where warehouse tenants reported seeing them paint over some of the windows of the vans. At 11 p.m. on July 21st, 6 days after the kidnapping, the cops showed up at the Woods' residence and began a thorough search. Soon enough, they found a heap of evidence, including guns and a piece of paper, on top of which was written the word plan. It was, indeed, a plan of the bus snapping. Also found was a rough draft of a ransom note. The public would not be privy to its contents immediately, but this is what the cops had in hand. Quote, "Your bus has been kidnapped. Put $2.5 million in each of the suitcases. Total $5 million. Use old bills. Have ready at Oakland Police Station. Further instructions pending until Sunday a.m. We are Beelzebub." End quote. By the way, Beelzebub, a common nickname for Satan, was misspelled to look something like Beelzebub. The note continued, quote, "Sunday, take suitcases to Oakland Airport. Have CHP plane pick up and transfer at 1,000 feet above ground to Santa Cruz. Then follow Highway 17 back to Oakland. Speed should be about 120 miles per hour ground speed. Rest of the message follows." End quote. I can't help but noting that the kids were taken on Thursday, put in the ground on Friday, and they were not going to ask for the ransom to be paid until Sunday. It seems like they were willing to let 26 children be scared to death for days, and maybe even worse. Did they even have enough food to last that long? I feed one kid. They eat 3 times a day, and they're fragile. The extent of the cruelty is stunning. In these cases, man, sometimes there's more than the usual amount of stuff to loathe. Anywho, 2 days after the ransom note was found, on July 23rd, Richard Schoenfeld and his attorney walked into the Oakland office of the Alameda County District and surrendered. The lawyer, Edward Merrill, had represented a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, the bunch that took Patty Hearst in 1975. Fred was arrested in Vancouver, British Columbia, 6 days later, on July 29th. He had been trying to retrieve a letter at Vancouver's main post office. A newscast at the time.
Frederick Woods was arrested by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police this afternoon, just across the Washington state border in Vancouver.
On the same day, James had been driving on Interstate 5 to, he said later, give himself up when he was pulled over near Menlo Park and taken into custody.
James Schoenfeld was captured at dawn today. Police say he ran hard all over the western United States, but he did not run well.
Law enforcement still had one more guy in mind. It seemed like the idea for the caper was, more or less, the subject of a screenplay written by a friend of Woods and the Schoenfelds. David Boston, the wannabe writer, had received a letter from Jim while he was on the lam in Canada. Jim wrote, quote, "If you want to make really good money ever on a movie, write about our deal. I think it would make a damn good movie of the week, if not a feature. It's big, real big, and a hot item. Everybody wants to know about it. My ending is not exciting enough, so you might have to kill some people or something." End quote. He added that he had wanted to put more weight on the buried moving van, but Richard had talked him out of it. Boston handed the letter over to the police and told them about a screenplay. That stoked suspicion about whether he'd actually been involved in it from the start. So the cops enlisted Clint Eastwood to ask Boston for a meeting to discuss the possibilities of turning it into a film. Boston jumped at the chance. The two met at a Los Angeles restaurant, and Boston handed his script to Clint, who handed it back to the cops. The cops examined it, but Boston's fingerprints matched nothing from the crime. The film was never made.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
A year after the arrests, after a change of venue, retired Riverside County Superior Court Judge Leo Deegan was selected to hear the case. The defendants decided to take their chances on his judgment and declined a jury trial, having pleaded guilty to simple kidnapping, but not to the kidnapping with bodily harm crime that prosecutors had charged them with. Over days of testimony, it was revealed that they never delivered the ransom note because Jim Schoenfeld, who had become obsessed with the Exorcist movie, wanted to check the spelling of Beelzebub before sending it. So they had shifted gears and tried to call the sheriff's office with the ransom demand, but the phone line was always busy. Oh, and after not being able to call in the ransom details, the threesome decided to nap for a while after their big night. When they woke up, the kids had already escaped. They also told the court that they had practiced the bus napping once and the bus had turned into a side road when they were just about ready to pounce. They said they were so relieved it hadn't worked, they immediately went to an A&W root beer stand to celebrate. And they said they never meant to bankrupt anyone, they just figured the state of California would pay the ransom. After all, state officials had just announced a $5 billion surplus. They figured nobody would even notice $5 million missing. And they had plans for that money. Woods had wanted to develop and patent a new way to put out wildfires, and he said he would have given the device to the state, who, you know, had already paid for it. Richard Schoenfeld said he planned to use the money to give the kids cars or motorcycles or horses, whatever they wanted. Their attorneys knew how this was going to make them look to the public. One pointed out that, quote, no Weinsteins were running the show, end quote. Now, there was plenty of evidence that the men had run up serious debt that they did not want their parents to know about, and that they figured this, well, was a good plan to recoup their losses. Judge Deegan said at sentencing that he was impressed that they were, quote, not people who developed habits of viciousness, end quote, and that they didn't intend to harm the children, but he didn't have the right to change the facts in applying the law. Enough harm had been done to the victims that the harsher sentence was appropriate. Woods and Jim Schoenfeld got life without the possibility of parole. Richard, because he was 22 at the time of the crime and because of a quirk in California law, got life with the possibility of parole. All the hostages were offered an all-expense-paid visit to Southern California to see Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm, another theme park. A special college fund was set up, and Ed Ray got a healthy retirement fund. The buses in the region all got CB radios, despite Ray explaining that he wouldn't have gotten reception in the area where they were taken, and he never would have been able to call anyone anyway. In some districts, boards decided school buses could not stop for any reason. Sweet Jennifer Brown told the judge during the trial that she had nightmares regularly still, and she saw herself being killed. She said that in those dreams, the kids were lined up and apples were placed on their heads when they were shot, like a William Tell trick. When asked by reporters why she thought the men did what they did, she replied that they hadn't had enough love in their lives. 4 years after the trio was convicted, an appellate court said the injuries suffered to the children did not amount to the legal standard of bodily harm. That meant they all would be eligible for parole. Some of the children, now adults, over the years showed up at least 60 times, 20 times per kidnapper, to argue against them being set free. Nevertheless, Richard Schoenfeld was released from prison in 2012. His brother Jim followed in 2015. Woods was paroled in 2022. Sally Marina of Madera County's District Attorney's Office argued against Wood's release to ABC News.
You know, when they arrested him, he was busy selling the rights to the movie. He's always been about the money. Whatever he had to do to get the money, he would have done to those kids, including bury him alive.
Jennifer Brown grew up, got married, had kids, and admitted it was a long time before she could sleep without a nightlight. She had testified at their trial.
The kidnappers were sitting to my left at a table. I remember giving my dad my gum because I told him I was going to spit my gum at him. I did my testimony, I answered my questions, and I left that courtroom with my head held high, and there was no way that I was going to let them see me cry.
Getting back to normal had been harder than she thought it'd be, but she wanted everyone to know those men did not keep her from having a wonderful life. Others felt differently. Mike Marshall didn't go on the Disneyland trip. He just wanted to forget about the whole thing. Almost 50 years later, Marshall told People magazine that before the kidnapping, he'd been looking forward to his future. After it, he said he, quote, couldn't see anything, end quote. He said he was drunk for the next 30 years. But recently, hearing from others how grateful they were that he had saved their lives, his perspective has changed some. Many told him that he had kept helping them through the hardest days of their lives because they remembered him scratching and clawing to free them and saying over and over, keep digging. To research this story, journalist Amy Wilson read decades of newspaper stories about the case, combed through the available television coverage at the time, and listened to a few retrospectives of the kidnapping. The 48 Hours episode, Remembering the Chowchilla Kidnapping, was especially helpful. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.